Now, we spoke to one who had but just awoke to understand the change that had taken place, and I could study the same bewilderment in another which I experienced under somewhat similar circumstances. Anon, we watched one, whose probationary rest being over, was looking away in the direction from which the friends were expected, who would escort her to the place prepared for her. Every incident had its own peculiar interest and charm, as it discovered the methods of God in dealing with the sons of men on earth, in leading the blind by a way they know not. Our conversation with these friends, I at length remarked to Symes, gives me the impression that you do not hold chorales here. Is that correct?
Yes.
My visitors are the opposite of those you saw at the Home of Rest, and need very different ministrations. They were victims who succumbed, against their better nature, to greedy intolerance. They were overpowered while struggling to get free. These are conquerors who, following the teachings and example of Jesus, have worked out their own salvation in spite of creed. Then perhaps you can answer me a question which puzzled me many times in the old life?
I will, if possible, he replied kindly.
Which of all the denominations, or religions if you will, contribute the highest percentage of the redeemed? Refers to the exaltation of a subject to divine level. This series of books by R.J. Lees virtually ignores this question, and leaves one with the notion that redemption has now occurred for those in heaven. This, we recognize but one religion here, that is, love, and all its disciples have but one denomination, lovers of mankind. No one of all the man-made religions holds a monopoly of this attribute. But earnest and conscientious followers of it may be found in all. Its worship is service to humanity, its litany, noble deeds, its prayers, tears of sympathy, its sermons, simple lives, known and read of all men, its songs are lullabies to soothe the broken-hearted, its faith the immolation of self, and its hope, heaven. This is the only religion which can write the passports of heaven for the pilgrims of earth. Systems of theology have no more charm for us here than they had on earth, but in every heart there is a latent ideal towards which all mankind is blindly reaching out, a vague and undefined hope to which all the nations are ignorantly aspiring, a settlement of political problems that is only just beyond the reach of statesmen, a method of international arbitration by which peace shall reign on earth. These are all generating in the womb of futurity. And oh! How near that future is, how soon might all be accomplished, if only systematic theology could be cleared away and simple-minded souls could raise the true standard of the cross that all the world might see and recognize that every difficulty would be overcome, every problem solved, and every ideal attained in Jesus. We were by this time passing through a magnificent vestibule leading evidently to the courtyard or garden, which I could see in the distance. From either side of us ran corridors, out of which apparently innumerable apartments opened, and here, I had a splendid opportunity for noticing the self-luminous atmosphere to which I have before alluded. In the very center of so vast a vestibule one would naturally expect to find an almost midnight gloom, yet neither here, nor in the corridors adjacent, could there be detected the slightest indication of a shadow. Staircases of stately proportions rose at intervals to the terraces above, on all of which, wherever facility offered, were found trees, plants, and flowers, in more than oriental luxuriance, interspersed with statuary and tapestries which baffle all attempts at description. On reaching the courtyard, I at once discovered the reason of its being selected as the starting point of my inspection of the palace. In the center stood, or played, I hardly know how to describe it, a unique aqua, botanical marvel which was at once both tree and fountain. From a coral-tinted basin it rose in a huge body of water, some 4 or 5 feet in diameter, as if passing through a transparent conduit. At the height of 15 feet, its branches began to reach out in every direction, each of which was luxuriant with its triple burden of ever-changing leaf, and flower and fruit. I say ever, changing, because no sooner had leaf, or flower or fruit reached full development than by some mysterious power it was severed from the tree, as though gathered by unseen hands, and carried into one or other of the multitude of apartments which completely surrounded us.
It was an object lesson in the process of nature, the mighty forces of which were visibly operating before my eyes. I gazed upon the sight in amazement, almost awe, and at the same time marveled to what use the products of this wonderful tree were applied. As if to answer me, Siams stooped and gathered two or three of the leaves which had fallen at our feet. In color they were of a pale, bright, almost emerald green, while to the touch they were soft and velvety. When I had thoroughly examined them, my companion closed his hand upon them, and as they were pressed I was conscious of a very soft and delicate odor, producing a marked and exhilarating effect upon me. Then he opened his hand, upon which there was left just a trace of moisture but no sign of the leaves remained. A smile passed across his features as he beheld my astonishment, and he proceeded to explain this singular phenomenon. "This," said he, "is the tree, and also the water of life, so necessary to restore the weary and recuperate the exhaustion of those who come here to rest. It forms a method of reinvigoration which is the equivalent of the chorale. The stream which supplies and energizes this tree, as also many other in similar homes, is the strongest and richest of which we have any idea. We are told it takes its rise in the vicinity of the throne of God, for it never varies in the constancy of its flow. To us who know it best and watch its workings, the most marvelous quality it possesses is its remarkable adaptation to the particular requirements of every case to which it ministers. It leaves nothing for us to do but watch and wait while it works a complete restoration. When its cooling spray falls into the eyes, the foundations of the fountain of tears are completely wiped away. It lingers upon the care-worn brow until every furrow has disappeared. It drops its seed within the broken heart, and then laves it with melody until the song of victory has bloomed. But come and see some of the friends who are lying beneath the benediction of its waters till they recover from the effects of earth's fitful fever. I shall not attempt to describe the apartments in which these weary children of earth were sleeping the shadows away. If words would serve me for the purpose, no mind imprisoned in the limitations of mortality has power to grasp it. Let it suffice to say that love had contributed the handiwork of its devotion, affection had lavished its choicest treasures. The gems of ease from every land had been improved upon, sympathy and skill had exhausted their store, houses, until the great designer of the heavens had made that resting place for his children touch the standard of his own desire, and then pronounced it good. On reaching the second terrace, Siams stopped as we neared the entrance to one apartment, in order to explain to me the circumstances of the case. Here was lying a mother whose awakening was being watched for by three of her children. She was the daughter of an ignorant but extremely orthodox tradesman, who had inherited his religion as a kind of heirloom. She married a man who had been set apart by his family for the pulpit, but he himself was too conscientious to preach what to him was but half the truth, and in spite of the urgent persuasions of both sides, persisted in following his trade as a printer. With the advent of family responsibilities, his newly born parental feelings still further widened the gulf between himself and orthodoxy, and he gave up the last idea of becoming a preacher. His wife was fearful, but her love was real. Whispers of his state of mind began to be heard in the church, and for the sake of others he was requested to resign. His wife went with him. Then the man's disappointed parents, seeing their hopes fast drifting into oblivion, laid their heads together to try and restore the wandering sheep, and after much prayer they came to the conclusion that God had ordained a little trial as a means of securing the backslider's return. They thereupon visited his employer, and by a few slanderous suggestions secured his dismissal. 9 months of gradually increasing privation followed, in which the three children were augmented by a fourth, but the righteous parents dare not help them to resist the chastisements of God by affording any relief. But the wife never allowed the fire of her love to go down. No murmur was ever breathed from her lips, no anxious inquiry if he had succeeded, when his weary footsteps sounded on her ears like a music at night, lest her asking should increase his disappointment. One by one she parted with every little treasure, which from her girlhood she had learned to prize, that she might contrive to find something for those still more precious treasures God had entrusted to her training. Still they withstood the entreaties of the church, for they failed to see that their misfortune was the will of God, and half suspected it had more to do with the will of a much less generous parent. It was a heavy battle they had to fight for years, at most the husband's success secured but a bare existence, and the children continued to come until 13 her called her mother. Bravely she bore her part, putting forth almost superhuman endeavors to make both ends meet. God knew what was best, and in the end all would come right if she did but do her duty. So it was that the midnight hours saw her mending, patching, darning, morning found her weary, planning, and hoping. In the lonely hours of the day, when the children were at school and her husband at his work, she was weeping, praying, and longing for the rest which never came. One by one three graves had been opened before her, and heaven received three darlings over whom her mother's heart yearned with an ever strengthening love. Yet for the world she had her smiles, and few people ever dreamed of the struggle with which she had to contend. She was not conscious of how she was over taxing herself, she only knew how much more was needed than she had time or strength to accomplish. But rest comes at length. The fierceness of the battle, the ceaseless turmoil, the unending strife, the hope deferred grew too heavy for her shoulders, and while yet comparatively young she sank beneath the load. As he finished his recital, he approached and drew aside the rich hangings which fell across the entrance, and we stood within the apartment where this heroine from life's battle slept, watched over most lovingly, can I say, patiently, by those three who had a right to call her by that sweetest name a woman knows. The eldest was a youth just short of manhood, the next a girl not much his junior, and the third a lad just entering on his teens. In their robes of almost untinted whiteness, they looked like angels waiting there, not bright and brilliant in their persons, but with a soft and subdued halo breaking from them, enough to show they were no denizens of earth. Two other friends were there besides, but Sam's made me to know that these were ministers whom Mahanian had left in attendance, when he received her from the body and brought her there. The only sounds which broke the silence were the soft kisses the children pressed upon her lips, and cheeks, and forehead, as though they were impatient for that sleep to end that they might hear her voice again. Ever and anon I saw the flush of excitement rise on each eager face as she turned or moved upon her couch, and I discerned that I had been brought here to see her wake. Presently she breathed a sigh, stretched, turned, and then stretched again. The attendants gently drew the children away, Sam's left me, and took his place beside the couch. Slowly he waved his hand over the sleeper's face, which now I could not see, but from the movements of her body I thought her sleep was nearly, if not quite, at an end. Another stretch, a quiet moment, then a long, drawn sigh, followed by, oh, Hda, ah, why, where am I? Mother! Cried all the children in chorus, as they bounded forward to embrace her. But I was outside. That meeting was too sacred for me to stand and gaze upon. Shortly afterwards the curtains were again drawn aside, and she was led forth to take her first glimpse of, shall I say, heaven? What else could it have seemed to her? Whatever it had previously been, it was undoubtedly heaven now to the children who clung so closely around her. How beautiful she looked in her newly found strength and peace, which clothed her like a robe of sweet repose, and the consciousness breaking upon her that she could never know weariness and weakness again. As they stood upon the edge of the terrace, among the flowers, for her to take a survey of the surroundings, I was surprised to find that Mahanian was at her side. In the concentration of my attention upon her, I had not noticed that it was he who led her from the room. Where and how had he come? When I hurried out he was not there, he had not entered since from the terrace, how had he come? Sam's joined me at this moment, and I referred my query to him. Mahanian brought her from earth, he replied, and therefore it was for him to be the first, after her children, to welcome her. I had no idea that he was here, he was not. When I saw her waking I sent for him. Does he live near, then? Near and distant only exists spiritually here, he replied. But I see you are not yet acquainted with our methods of communication and travel. No. You remember, he continued, when you were at the corral, Mahanian projected a flash of light when he wished to speak to you. Yes. You did not understand that, but your friend read the message it conveyed and gave the interpretation. Those flashes fly with the rapidity of thought, and find their destination instantly, and when occasion demands, we have the power to travel with equal celerity. So you see, prayer is answered while we are yet speaking, and the idea of time and space annihilated in spiritual ministration. Then you do not always walk or ride? By no means. Why, in the visits you have been making, your passage has been through the air frequently, only it comes so natural here that you have not noticed it. Any further conversation was interrupted by Mihanian calling us to congratulate our sister, after which the children made a long explanation as to who Sams was, and all he had done for them while they were waiting. Then gently drawing her towards the edge of the terrace, Mihanian threw his arm around her, and in one happy group they commenced their aerial journey towards that rest which was the legitimate compensation of that once oppressed soul. Several other visits were paid and the stories of their lives recounted for my instruction. But I must content myself with recording the last, which at once arrested my attention by the presence of a number of bright purple hair, lines which, emanating from the body of the sleeper, passed across and out of the room, I knew not whither. My friend informed me that these were love cords which existed by reason of the uncontrollable grief of the friends left behind. Great difficulty, he explained, is frequently experienced in dealing with these earth attractions, and if friends could only know how their unrestrained grief finds a response in those they mourn, disturbing and breaking their rest, it would do much to remedy the wrong they are thus unintentionally the cause of. Should the sleeper awake before the force of these cords can be weakened, which not unfrequently happens, the soul is drawn back again to earth, and naturally participates in the agony of its friends, which is also increased by the discovery that it is both powerless to make its presence known, or in any way minister to the relief of the mourner. In the case before us, messengers had been continually dispatched, and every available influence employed to try and stem the torrent of these sorrowing friends. Now she was waking, and Sams could see that the inevitable must come. This reminded me of my conversation with Kushner about crossing the mists. But he was away, having left me as soon as we passed the bridge on our arrival. I mentioned the matter to Sams and dared to venture the hope that if she was drawn back, and anyone followed her, I might be allowed to bear them company. I will send for Kushner, he answered, perhaps he will undertake the mission, and take you with him. I saw the message of light fly upon its errand, then its response, and almost immediately Kushner himself was beside us. I was now to witness a second awakening, which might have been as beautiful and peaceful as the other. But, oh, how different! My reader, think of these experiences of mine as you may, class them in the category of fiction if you choose. But for mercy's sake hear me as I plead for self-restraint when you mourn the absence of a loved one called away. God knows the cry of a broken heart is bitter, but remember, if the first duty of a follower of Christ is love, the second is self-abnegation. Your loss is their gain, then I ask you rather to rejoice, for great is their reward. If you really love them, calm your grief. For the discarding of the body has not disturbed the seat of love, and your agony vibrates on its cords as much as ever, and reaching them where they are, it disturbs their rest and postpones their happiness. Remember while here their joy corresponded to your participation therein, do you think they are so immediately changed that they could gaze in rapture upon the Savior's face, perfectly conscious of, yet indifferent to, your agony? If you grieve for love's sake, calm yourself. If you weep for sentiment and fashion, you may continue, that will never reach them where they are. Love, pure, unselfish love has this power, and it is to this I now appeal. You would not weep if you could stand for one brief moment where I have stood, and see the things which I have seen. You would then be content to let the loved ones rest in peace upon the bosom of their God, and therefore I appeal to you, dry up your tears and let them rest until your morning breaks, and your shadows have flown away. By this time there was not the slightest doubt about the sleep being at an end, and I could see that with every fresh sign of consciousness the lines exerted an increased influence upon her. In her half-sleep she murmured several names as though she was being called but was too weary to rouse up at present. Then she reluctantly woke into a dazed, half-petulant state. Next a hazy recollection seemed to seize her. Shuddering, She turned in the direction in which the lions were running, at the same time vacantly responding, "I'm coming, dear." Then she rose from the couch, the cords momentarily increasing their power over her. Slowly she moved at first, but every step augmented her strength and speed. Anxious marks began to show upon her face as she drew their hangings aside and stepped upon the terrace. Her excitement now grew intense. She hurried forward, and I would have interposed to save her from throwing herself over, but Kushne held me back. Mistaken love was carrying her to such an agony as I little dreamed of then, and no one had any right to use force to restrain her. All we could do was to follow and save. She reached the edge of the terrace but did not hesitate or waver. She threw herself over and was gone. Kushne grasped my hand, and bade me come across the mists upon a mission of salvation. Chapter 12 Across the Mists. For the first time, which was perhaps due to what Sams had said to me, I realized that we were not walking, and my rapid passage through the air was as pleasant as it was novel. There was no effort in my flight, in fact I was not aware of exercising any power of locomotion at all. Kushne held my hand and perhaps exerted whatever force was necessary to carry us on our way. For a considerable time he did not speak, or give the slightest indication that he was conscious of my presence. Our transit was certainly not an instantaneous one, perhaps I was not yet capable of making such, or it may have been due to other causes, I cannot tell, but when I saw the mists only a short distance in front of us, a thousand questions rushed through my mind, while a thrill of excitement took possession of me. Under my changed conditions, would the earth offer itself as a surprise, or not? At what distance would it be? Should I know the first place I sighted? Which, if any, of my acquaintances should I see first? Should I see London at all? We drew close to the mists but made no sign of descending to pass through them, at which I was somewhat surprised, until I remembered Helen saying, that in going back to Earth we cross over them. Yes, we were above them. Now for the grand secret from the reverse side of life. What would it be? What would it reveal? Why? We had passed them. It was dark and I was disappointed. I would much rather have crossed in the daylight on my first return. It was so cold, too, I felt the chill pass through me, and for a moment I hesitated to go forward. I had no idea at what distance, or in which direction the earth lay. In all the gloom, whether far or near, there was no beacon light to attract my attention. Kushne urged me on for a time, then halting, still in the darkness, asked me playfully what I thought of my view of Earth from the immortal side. I have not seen it yet, I replied, nor perceive any sign of it unless these indistinct and confused sounds arise from it. That is just what I was expecting. You have fallen into the one great errors of mankind in misunderstanding the relationship which exists between the physical and the spiritual sides of life. This arises from want of thought, and forms the greatest stumbling block in the way of communication between ourselves and those left behind, and its discussion opens up the whole of this question. In the body they fail to grasp the true difference existing between the spiritual and physical conditions, very erroneously imagining that the latter is the superior of the two. They hold that to throw off the body is to give up all advantages, all powers, and all achievements. Work, progress, and development cease, and the soul becomes visionary and intangible, being incapable of following any of the pursuits for which the earth afforded it every advantage. Death puts down its foot and says to the mighty influences of the mind, "Thus far, but no farther." The grave opens its jaws and cries to the swelling ocean of human capability, "Here shall thy proud waves be stayed." In the body they are able to attack and overcome difficulties, but we have lost the power of doing so, having laid it down at the grave. Such is the delusion cherished by one section of humanity. Our church friends form another. They suppose, and very correctly so, that if communication was to be opened the stream of revelation would be continued, but they fondly imagine that God has said his last word in that respect, therefore argue that any attempt to break the silence of the tomb is an artifice of the devil to destroy their souls. Now a little quiet and impartial reasoning would soon disturb the foundations of both these objections and opens the door to more light upon the subject. In the first instance the brain is not the mind, but simply the convenient instrument by which it operates under certain circumstances. Between the two there exists an impassable gulf, so deep and dark that the wisest man has not discovered by what means they are connected. To base an assumption upon this ignorance is the height of folly, and equivalent to declaring that the violinist is dead because the strings of his violin are broken. The second, or church side of the objection, is, if possible, the more inconsistent of the two. They worship God as unchangeable without variableness or shadow of a turning, which knowledge of him is derived from the immutability of his laws. The Bible is interwoven in its warp and weft with the ministry of angels. The reappearance of Christ after death is the very cornerstone of their faith, without which it would be vain, and yet they deny the possibility of an open communion and declare that this changeless God has changed, or at least this one law has, and that angelic ministry has ceased. You are quite right in your indictments, I said, but I fail to see what connection this has with my not being able to see the earth, that is, if we are within sight of it. That which puzzles you is capable of a very simple explanation, and you will then see that the two illustrations are grounded in one truth. Our theological friends do not believe in angel ministry, because we are insensible to their sight. You also are unable to appreciate our present contiguity to earth for the same reason. Why is this? Simply because you have changed the standpoint of your observation, and in doing so have become invisible to earth and the physical, while they have at the same time become equally imperceptible to your spiritual sense. To yourselves you are both as real and tangible as ever, but to each other you are as unreal as you have been taught to consider us to be. So you have to look for earth now as to you a visionary, intangible, and almost immaterial world, and as such I will point it out, while you, as a spiritual being, will remain the substantial and real. Is not this contrary to all your ideas? Certainly, but like most other people my ideas were hazy and unsatisfactory. But you thought of us as invisible, immaterial, impalpable creatures? I suppose I did, whenever I gave any thought to the subject at all. So we are to them generally, and so are they to us. This is due to the fact that the point of sensation of resistance is different. Now you will be in a position to understand what has been a mystery. You still continue to be as real and tangible as ever, but everything else is altered. The spirit world has become the objective and natural, while earth has changed to the invisible, to a great extent. That which formerly was solid and obstructive to you is now no longer so. Buildings, trees, and even the physical bodies of men are no more to us than the purple haze which wraps itself around the shoulders of a mountain, and offer no more resistance. Why, Krishna? I gasped, as the revelation unfolded itself, and following the motion of his hand, I gradually perceived the visionary outlines of objects surrounding us. This is the greatest surprise of all. How can I understand it? You must be patient, he replied. A student does not understand a language as soon as he has mastered the alphabet, but that does not hinder him from continuing his study, if he is wise. No man knows how he is able to think, but every searcher for knowledge is glad to use his brain, in spite of the explanation which lies beyond his reach. So must we act in our development. Every successive stage through which we pass will have its mystery, but each in turn will be solved, and give place to greater problems, until all our powers having been unfolded, we shall see God. If our friends on earth would recognize this, they would fulfill their mission better. I can begin to see now the difficulty of reaching them, but is it not possible to do something to correct these errors? Yes. Love conquers death, and that one great law which governs and controls everything with us, is also the means by which we may reach and save mankind. Sympathy, whether pure or impure, base or noble, holy or unholy, has a natural attraction for that which is like itself, and its power is not destroyed by the grave, as you have seen in the cause of our present mission. Love links soul with soul, and has power to bridge any gulf if it is only strong and true. This is partially admitted on earth. For instance, it is allowed that a mother who is with us may be cognizant of the continued welfare of her child. Then why should they deny the possibility of information being carried the other way? The experiences of the child cannot be of any assistance to the mother, but those of the parent would make an inestimable difference to the child. Why then should the useless knowledge be ordained, and that, which would be helpful denied? Is this the usual method of God's procedure?